WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Throughout this last week of the decade, we're featuring interviews from Fresh Air's 1980s archives. Today's guest, Richard Price, began the decade as a hot young novelist and ended the decade having written one of the surprise hit films of 1989, the erotic thriller Sea of Love. He also wrote screenplays for three of Martin Scorsese's movies, The Color of Money, New York Stories, and the upcoming film based on the bestseller about the mafia, Wise Guy. When I spoke with Price in early 1986, none of his movies had been released yet, but two of his novels, The Wanderers and Blood Brothers, had been adapted into films by other writers. All of Price's novels are about young men who have reached a dead end in their lives. Like most of the characters in his books, Price is from a Bronx, lower-middle-class, multi-ethnic neighborhood. Unlike his characters, Price had no trouble getting out of the neighborhood and making a name for himself. His first novel, The Wanderers, about a teenage gang in the Bronx in the early 1960s, was published when Price was just 24. Our interview begins with a reading from The Breaks, Price's 1984 novel. It opens at the main character's college graduation. Going to college out of town was his ticket out of the Bronx and away from his family. But when he's later turned down by law school, he ends up back home looking for a new way out.
The main character's name is Peter Keller, and this is the year that he's trapped home after graduation, where his plans for law school are scotched. And this is what his experience of June, the first June at home after 4 years away, is like. The entire month of June was siesta hot. The weather combined with my home again emotional jet lag to give me a psychosomatic case of tired blood. After spending the morning staggering around for a job or shaking hands with my father, I had to fight off the desire to go back up to Yonkers and take a nap. If I was too beat to track down leads in the afternoons, I'd duck into movies or museums. I knew that in my mental state, naps could kill. At nights, the three of us would sit in the living room, watch Cannon, the Mod Squad, ABC's Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday night at the movies, the news, Johnny Carson, and Crash. I didn't watch too much television in college, but when I did, it was with a loud crowd around the dorm lounge, the fraternity lounge, or in my senior year garden apartment with Bam Bam and some dates or neighbors. Whatever we watched in those 4 years was secondary to the wisecracks, the eating, and the grass. TV nights with my father and Vi, Vi is Peter's stepmother, were silent affairs. At first I tried to drum up some group hysteria, frantically insulting Cannon's fatness or Chester's limp on the Gunsmoke reruns. But the best I could score were some polite chuckles from my father. Vi wouldn't know a funny line if it bit her on the ass. I had never seen her laugh in my life. One night toward the end of June on NYPD, we saw a cop come across his partner lying in a pool of blood with what looked like a cannonball wound in his gut. The cop bent down and said, "Are you okay?" And I exploded with a half dozen responses in 10 seconds. My father missed the wounded cop's answer because of my floor show, and wincing in irritation, asked Vi what the guy had said. Vi quoted it back verbatim, and An Evening with Pete Keller closed out of town forever. The next morning I woke up and realized I had two choices: either get on the stick and land some kind of job that would make me feel like a human being, or wind up as the subject of an article in the American Journal for the Study of Mass Murderers. I covered the kitchen table with the want ad sections of every newspaper I could find and started making calls. I answered one ad for someone who desired to break into the magazine world, but after a 20-minute failed conversation with a woman who described herself as personnel master, I figured out that the position was for a boy Friday in the office of a small, erratically published dominatrix journal. The second call went better. There was an ad in the Village Voice requesting verbally aggressive people. I got a Mrs. Himmel on the line and found out I had reached a phone soliciting outfit called American Communicators. Mrs. Himmel sounded cool and regal, with a slight trace of the Danube in her voice. She seemed relaxed and intelligent, so I took a chance and told her I had a college degree. She cooed with approval, and that spurred me on to reveal that I had graduated from the Harvard of upstate New York. Honors in English, how's that for verbal? It was my first interview where the extent of my education didn't do me in, and laying out my resume for Mrs. Himmel made me feel like Clark Kent slowly unbuttoning his white shirt. I don't know if it was her leisurely curiosity or just my hunger for a real conversation, but it turned out to be the best talk I'd had since college. I wanted to give her my life story, the tears, the fears, the laughs. I totally forgot it was a job interview, and I wound up running down every accomplishment since kindergarten except for winning the Triple Crown and Punch Bowl for the 1957 season. She requested my presence for an orientation meeting the next day, and I hung up so excited that I walked around the house for a half hour absently clapping my hands.
And that's a selection from Richard Price's latest novel, The Breaks. The character in The Breaks is the first character, main character, in any of your novels to have actually finished college. Most of your novels are about characters who come out of working class, lower middle class neighborhoods in the Bronx. Were there a lot of writers writing about those kinds of neighborhoods when your first novel was published?
Well, if there were, the novel might never have gotten published. This is something that I usually say about that the whole situation of me trying to be a writer in that kind of environment. I mean, I don't want to romanticize the poverty or something. It was basically, you know, working-class neighborhood. What happens, though, in a working-class neighborhood is that the parents are children of people that try to scratch livings out of the Depression. So my parents were kids during the Depression, haunted by economic survival. And if it was in the 60s, and you were the first kid in that family to go to college, and you wanted to do something in which there was no blue chip guarantee of a professional job at the end of the education, they thought you were nuts. So the brightest minds of my housing project and millions of housing projects like that across America, I would guess, would go to engineering school or medical school because there was a job. If you were going to Cornell like I did, and your father's putting the money together for you to go, and you want to be something like a poet or a painter or a dancer, they would look at you like you were mentally defective and you were wasting their money. So it was very hard for a kid to get the validation to do something creative. Myself, I was so psyched out by that thinking that even though I wanted to be a writer, I got a degree in labor relations.
Just so you could
just because I didn't
do the
feel
right
like
thing.
Well, I thought, well, gee, maybe writing could be a hobby, you know, and then it sort of took over. When I was in college.
It seems important for all of your characters to get out of the neighborhood and to break away from the family, but it's really difficult for most of them to achieve that. Mm-hmm. Were you in that kind of situation? Was it hard for you to get out? Was college your ticket out?
I used to think it was just a matter of like getting away from the family or some doctrinaire attitude about, you know, the politics of, you know, families smothering children or economic survival. I think it's more like this general feeling I had all my life, which I think a lot of people have, which is, where is it? You know, it's like you're looking for it and you're trying to escape something because what you're doing now, there's an old Lord Buckley routine where there's a conquistador. Lord Buckley was a jazz comic in the early 50s, and he had a routine about Cabeza de Vaca, which a conquistador was looking for India, wound up in St. Petersburg, Florida. And what he said to his troops is, we didn't know where we was, but we knew where we was wasn't it. And I think what I've been writing about is that feeling of, like, escape. It's not the family. It's not the economics. It's something intangible. And I've just come to, I used to think it was something tangible, like economics or family. But it's really, it's that feeling of, like, I still feel it. No matter what you have, you're over here, but it's over there. And the minute you're over there, it's over here. You know, and it's that zip-zip roadrunner game that you play with something that you can't get a hold of that I think I've been writing about all along.
But it's interesting, once you got out of the Bronx and you actually started writing, what you were writing about was the thing that you left, which was the Bronx and family.
Well, that's the only way. I mean, what else can you write about? The reason, well, I mean, I used to teach writing, and I don't think you can write about anything if it's if you're surrounded by it, because you can't see the forest for the trees, to use a cliche. When I went away to college, my life changed so radically. And I knew I was never going to go back. And it was something in my life finally that had the end attached to it, which a lot of young writers don't have because there's not that much that has finished in their life. And I had gone, after Cornell, I had gone to Stanford, which I'd never been out of New York State in my life. And I knew whether I liked the Bronx or didn't like the Bronx, it was over. It was a part of my life that was over. And it would only exist as long as I could remember it. And it had nothing to do whether it was good or bad. It was just a part of my life that was finished. And out of that panic of losing a part of my life, I forced it to crystallize, you know, to write it down just before it escaped, you know, and I got senile or something.
Once you left the Bronx and you were with other people who weren't from the Bronx, did you start mythologizing that into something maybe larger than it was or different from what it was?
Well, Yeah, not. I mean, I was sort of mythologized at more than me self-promoting the fact that I was Bruce Springsteen or Lou Reed or something like that. I mean, I think what happened is that basically I was like a Jewish working class kid, and I wrote about Italian kids because I had felt sort of psyched out, because I felt, what could I say after Philip Roth or after Michael Gold or somebody like that? So I thought, and I knew, you know, I grew up in a housing project which was pretty eclectic, and its collection of people, it was truly integrated. So I, you know, I was rubbing elbows with everybody, so it was just as easy for me to write about Italians. But what happened is when the book came out, I became the first person since James Farrell wrote Studs Lonergan or Hubert Selby wrote Last Exit to Brooklyn to get down into grits and the depth and everything. So everybody assumed that I graduated from Odyssey House as opposed to college, or, you know, I write with a switchblade. You know, and people were, like, scared of me, and it got to the point where they were kind of disappointed that I wasn't even Catholic, you know. I mean, people sort of wanted me to be this guy who wrote with his femur, you know, dipped in his victim's blood or something. You know, and I got kind of caught up in that, you know, because it's like I was 24 at the time, and, you know, you don't know whether to go to the bathroom or wind your watch half the time when you're 24 and you're getting all this stuff thrown at you, and you're getting, you know, you have a hard time knowing who you are, let alone getting this romanticized media thing thrown at you about yourself, and you start buying your own copy after a while. So then I started lying. I told people I was formerly Catholic, or, you know, I went to a different high school than I really did, you know. I went to DeWitt Clinton instead of Bronx High School of Science or something, but...
Did you develop a thicker accent?
Well, that happened not from writing The Wanderers. That happened because when I went away to Cornell up in Ithaca, New York, I felt so threatened by all these people who had real, like, Midwestern accents. If they came from Peru or Indiana, it was equally exotic to me because I had never met anybody outside. I thought the whole world was Italians, blacks, Jews, and Catholics. I never met a white Protestant person in my life before. And I felt very threatened by everybody else's sort of exoticism. So I think as a matter of survival, I sort of intensified my own exoticism, and I developed a worse Bronx accent in Ithaca, New York than I ever had in the Bronx because I never needed it before.
The first novel, The Wanderers, was about street gangs in the Bronx, teenage gangs. Were you ever in a gang? Did you have friends in gangs?
There's a comedian that I forgot the guy's name. I think it was, well, I don't know what his name is, but he had this thing that he was in the Goldberg gang. And I said it was no real big deal. We'd walk down the street and somebody would say, hey, here comes the Goldberg gang. And somebody else would say, big deal, what are they going to do, algebra? You know, that was kind of, you know. I mean, like I said, you know, I rubbed elbows with, like, tougher kids, you know, and nobody ever wants to be who they are. Everybody's, you know, kids want to be, like, athletes or, you know, like a Jewish kid wants to be James Brown. It's like, tell me I'm not who I am. Tell me there's something else out there.
What I figure you probably were, though, was the comedian and the writer.
I was, like, class clown, you know, and, yeah, I was, you know, well, what happens is, like, when you're 13 years old and it's like, you know, you can't tolerate just being like everybody else, so you got to find some ace in the hole that you have that would sort of elevate you above everybody else. And everybody tries to pick a specialty, whether it's being a math genius or, like, you have a nice voice or you're, like, a beautiful girl. Or, you know, for me, it was being the poet because, and you know, it just took my run-of-the-mill adolescent mopiness. And instead of being mopey, I was being, like, melancholic, sensitive, you know. I wasn't lonely. I was the lone wolf, you know, because us poets, you know, we have to suffer. And, you know, it just elevated the pedestrianness of my adolescence in my own mind. So I was more interested in the rapping than the gift. Yeah, you know, I didn't know if I had any talent or not. I just liked the idea of being a poet. That's what I grabbed onto.
What about being funny? Was that important too?
Yeah, sure. It was just a survival. It's just, you know, you want to stand out. You want to be different. Anybody who's a writer or a painter or anything in the arts is no portrait of mental health. I mean, I think one of the things above and beyond the desire to make art is this feeling of that it is intolerable to not stand out, to not be noticed, you know, and you're going to, when you're a kid, you're usually, like, really weird and on the edge of things, and you're a lemon, And then if you become a successful artist in some way, you've learned how to make lemonade out of the lemon that you were, you know. But what the underbelly of it is I have to be an artist. I have to take this loneliness and this perimeterhood and make it work, you know, because there's no way on earth that I could be, like, undistinguished. You know, it's not a happy or a proud choice. It's a desperate choice.
Well, I hope you don't mind my mentioning this, but your right arm is I don't know exactly what the problem is, but you don't have, I think,
well, I have cerebral palsy, and it's like a mild thing. It's like some people notice it, some people don't. But for me, since we're doing Dr. Freud, I think for me, what it was is that when I was a little kid, everybody treated me like different and special. It's like, what's wrong with your hand? What's wrong with your arm like that? And on one hand, it's kind of depressing, pardon the pun, it's kind of depressing, you know, to be noticed for that stuff. But on the other hand, you get hooked on everybody, you know, thinking of you as a little different, even though it's sort of a weird thing to be, you know. I just, for everybody, I think there's something. Look, if I had sort of like a perfect Nazi android body, I think it would be something else. You know, just for me, it was just the hand. If it wasn't for the hand, it would be something else.
One of the things you do in your novels is write about very macho subcultures and very, very macho male relationships, whether it's father and son or friends. And I know that that's not your sensibility. Is it hard to write about that kind of macho sensibility and not share it or endorse it yourself?
Well, you know, the point is that, you know, when I was a teenager, just writing, I was thinking and looking at things with a 15-year-old point of view. Now that I'm 36, I have a 16-year-old point of view, which is to say there's a part of me that still wants to be this tough guy. I mean, I still, like, flirt with weightlifting and do all this dumb stuff, you know. So it's not like, I mean, it's like I know better, but so what? You know, there's part of me that, you know, well, I wouldn't do what Rambo did, but I wouldn't mind having his body, you know. It's like that old Woody Allen joke. It's like the lady comes in and says to the shrink, my husband thinks he's a chicken, and we're going nuts. He says, well, come in, well, I can cure him. No, we need the eggs. You know what I mean? If there's a part of me that still does that, da-da-da-da, in my head, I just still have these theme songs of, you know, in my head. I mean, I can analyze them to death, but we need the eggs. You know, it's still like a part of me. I can't help it.
Your first two novels were about Italian families. The second two novels star Jewish main characters. Why did you make the switch?
Well, I got tired of passing. you know, it's like imitation of life. I just realized, well, what happened is I realized that the people that I had to write about were not the Portnoys and were not, you know, Saul Bellow characters or basically working class people. I wasn't writing about the Jewish culture or the Italian culture, I was writing about working class culture, and the fact is that I did know working class Jews better than I did knew working class Italians. And as I got older, I became into myself a little bit more, and I felt less of a need. I was getting farther and farther away from that wanting to be James Brown or wanting to be not me. You know, I felt, you know, you feel a little bit better about yourself. And I realized I had all this untapped territory. I wasn't writing about, you know, the oi 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 Jews, and I wasn't writing about the Jewish intellectuals living on West End Avenue. So I was neither Cynthia Ozick or Philip Roth or Bruce J. Friedman. I had a housing project, people that could either be Jewish or Italian. The Judaism was not that important to them. You know, if you look at the last two books, I mean, nobody goes to synagogue or nobody talks about the Holocaust or something. It's like they're New Yorkers, really.
I think of you as being influenced as much by movies and TV and stand-up comedy and rock and roll as you are by other novels. Do you think of your work that way?
Yeah, I think I've been influenced much more by film and television than I have by literature. I mean, I was a TV baby, Miss Frances Ding Dong School up to the Twilight Zone, you know, and whatever, in movies right away. And I've always been interested more in like storytelling than in writing, per se. Writing is my medium. I knew nothing about film technique, so I wound up being a writer.
There's a lot of rock and roll in your novels. Characters are always putting on records that are really important to them. What did rock and roll mean for you when you were growing up?
The same thing, pretty much what I said, which is escape. It's like, I'm not me, I'm Dion. I'm not me, I'm James Brown. I'm up there and I'm wearing these gold lame tight pants with a satin cummerbund and flamenco heel shoes, and I've got 9 pounds of pomade in my hair, and I'm flipping a mic out 90 miles an hour every way to compass, and nobody has ever seen anything like this, and I'm covered with sweat, and I got a voice that could shatter glass in another zip code, man. And what it all boils down to is I'm not me. Thank God. Here we go. I had my ticket. I had my airplane ticket every time I put a record on.
Did you listen to a lot of Lenny Bruce?
Lenny Bruce is my hero. My two heroes in terms of writing were Lenny Bruce, in a funny way, and Hubert Selby. Because Hubert Selby was the first time I ever read anything that was of my time that was in print. And so therefore I found my own experience as valid grounds for literature. Even though I might have been crazy about Oliver Twist, Oliver Twist didn't play in Epoxide Projects. Lenny Bruce, the way he spoke and his pacing or his humor, and first my first exposure to Lenny Bruce is they had a book called The Essential Lenny Bruce, which is a paperback, which are just basically transcripts of his club acts. And I saw that on paper, and it was like 3D, the words. It was my introduction to like perfect, ear-perfect dialogue, because it was tape transcripts. And I never saw language. I never saw a page alive like that. So Hubert Selby told me it was okay to write about where I came from. And Lenny Bruce told me sort of how to talk about it.
Novelist and screenwriter Richard Price recorded in 1986.